Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with baseball writers and authors, artists and musicians, filmmakers, basically anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. My first memories of Fritz Peterson were as a happy-go-lucky ballplayer, as evidenced by his Topps baseball card the year after his rookie season. And why not? He had just finished a 12-11 campaign with a 3.31 ERA and allowing just 196 hits in 215 innings. The good times were few and far between, as Peterson was a victim of bad timing, missing the team's glory years as they sank into a miasma of frustration. He would go on to pitch another 10 seasons, including stops in Cleveland and Texas, before retiring at the age of 34. But as we know, you're an ex-player much longer, God willing, than a player, and you have to find other things to do with your life. Unfortunately, Peterson's health has not been the best in recent years. This is one reason why he decided to take up writing as a cathartic exercise. All of his books have been self-published. His first, Mickey Mantle is Going to Heaven, came out in 2009. The second title, The Art of Deconditioning, Eating Your Way to Heaven, was released in 2012. This year, Peterson published When the Yankees Were on the Fritz, revisiting the Horace Clark years, a memoir of his seasons when the Yankees spent most of their time struggling to maintain a .500 record. I spoke with Peterson recently about this project and his previous ones. Fritz Peterson, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks, Ron. How you doing?
Good, thanks. So, why did you decide to do this book?
You know what? It changed names three times. It started out Mel and I, and then Teammates for Life, and then Marty Appel suggested, why not When the Yankees Were on the Fritz, since I was there all the years we lost. So, since he suggested it, I did it, because he's a good writer.
Now, the subtitle is Revisiting the Horace Clark Era. Now, that was, as you well know, it was kind of a dark time for Yankee fans. The team transitioned from its glory years, the tail end of its glory years of Whitey Ford and Mickey Mantle and Barrett and Nelson Howard, to those days. When you signed with the team, What did you expect? Did you expect something like this was going to happen, or do you expect that it's just going to go on as it was?
Yeah, I thought it would go on just like it always did. In fact, my scouts, Lou Maguala, and I can't remember the other one's name right now, convinced me, because I was deciding between Kansas City at that time and the Yankees, they convinced me that, hey, look at the records. The Yankees are always in the World Series, so you'll always get a World Series share. And I bought it. And lo and behold, none.
Do you think it was fair that it became known as the Horace Clark era?
Yeah, I really do. It could have very well been called the Fritz Peterson era. but Horace, as he says in his little comments someplace, said he got the blame, he thinks, because he was always out there, and the Yankees were always losing. So he was synonymous with being a loser. And I think that's probably correct, and also I do think that some of the real baseball people, the writers and stuff that could see what's going on, knew that Horace was a little bit of a problem for us, holding us back from winning, because he could not turn a double play. And it was disheartening for us pitchers, even though it wasn't out in the open. It was something that was just, we'd look at each other when we saw a chance for Horace, and he jumped out of the way or something, and so it was kind of a negative thing that was happening. And we didn't say anything, because what are you going to say? I mean, that's Ralph's business, Ralph Houk. And Ralph wasn't that kind of manager, and the same with us. He wasn't on us all the time, making us nervous of every pitch, maybe like George Steinbrenner would have been. So Horace didn't know. Roy didn't know that he was playing too deep, because his arm had been hurt. I didn't know that before. And then Jerry Kenney just wasn't good enough to be a Yankee third baseman. So those were the three things that were an impediment, and I think that's how Horace got that name. And I feel bad for him because he's really a nice guy. And so is Jerry Kenney and especially Roy White. Wonderful people.
See, now I'm thinking of it from a slightly different viewpoint. The Yankees were primarily known as a great offensive team. So I think the disappointments from those years, I'm thinking of somebody like Joe Pepitone or Tom Tresh and how they didn't live up to the expectations that were put on them. So that's why
some
of us feel that you know it's tough for a middle infielder not known for the offense to take so much of a hit on this.
Right. No, you're right. And I never really thought of it like that because I kind of Tommy Tresh was also a wonderful person, and I hated to see his career going down the tube so fast, and it was. And he felt worse than anybody. But, I mean, he ended up hitting under 200, didn't he, the last year with the Yankees? I don't know the exact thing. And then Joe Pepitone is Joe Pepitone. he's a great guy, and he's harmless, you know, even though he looks dangerous. But he'd never fight you because he wouldn't want to lose that wig of his.
So let me ask you, as a pitcher, and you talk about the defensive flaws of the team. Now, when I look I follow the Mets these days, so when I look at that young group of pitchers who do so well, and they don't get the offensive support that they need, obviously, and one little thing goes wrong in an infield that's in transition as they wait for David Wright to come back and they're moving players off.
Uh-huh.
How frustrating is that for a pitcher?
Oh, it's horrible.
But you can't really, I mean, these are your teammates. You shouldn't really be showing
No, and we didn't. You know, and I think it was the hardest on Mal and I because we pitched the most innings. We were always number one or two and both kind of sinker ball pitchers. And it was stressful not having an offense that could produce like they do today, probably 5 runs a game. We, at most, would get 3 on the average. Mostly more than that, 2, and we were expected to win with that. And so we had to go all the way a lot of times, even though it would have been nicer not to have to go all the way. We did have 2 or 3 great relief pitchers on and off, Aker and Lindy McDaniel and especially Sparky Lyle. So we got a break once in a while, but it made us tired. It still does to this day. I want to take a nap right now thinking of how hard it was.
Now, you were a rookie, obviously, at one point. How were you treated when you came up by the Yankees? Because in those days, I think that was the tail end of treating rookies with somewhat of a disdain, with somewhat of they're trying to take away my job. And they were treated nicely.
Right. No, I was still in on the old school there. They didn't really... I mean, I got along with everybody. I was a good pitcher from my first game on, and so I didn't take much of a hit. But, for instance, Whitey Ford at the end of my first year, he said, rookie, he said, don't send us any Christmas cards till you're here for 5 years. And he meant it, and I bought it. And then along the way comes players like Stan Bonson and Thurman Munson, who expected to be waited on by these guys.
The rookies now, how they come up through the system with such a sense of entitlement because they've been getting publicity since they were on travel teams, practically.
Exactly. And so much money. I mean, what's the minimum? $500,000 now?
Yeah.
And we were getting, our minimum was $7,000, and it was actually hard to buy equipment there. In fact, Al Downing one year saw the Rawlings band, and Al, being a wonderful person himself, said, hey, why don't you give Fritz a pair of spikes? He could use one, you know, because mine were wearing out. And he knew that it was tough living in New York City on $7,000. So today, with the money and the entitlement and the publicity and everything, these rookies probably don't feel like rookies.
And what about you later in your career? How did you treat rookies when they came up?
Real well, because I knew the feeling of loneliness when I first got there, because nobody knew me. Mickey Mantle actually came over to me. I was sitting in my locker one day, and he came over and stand in front of me, puts out his hand and said, "Hi, Fritz, I'm Mickey Mantle." as though I didn't know who it was, you know. But he just said, I wanted to just say hello. He said, where are you from? I said, Crystal Lake, Illinois. And Mickey knew the pressure because he was a god, you know, and us guys coming up for the minor leagues the year before, here we are, we watched this guy hit home runs for maybe 15 years on television, and here he's our teammate, and coming over to say hi to me. I don't think so, but it was so.
Now, what did you think about the selection of Mantle, Ruth, Gehrig, and DiMaggio as the franchise four for the Yankees at the All-Star game? I mean, there's certainly so many guys to choose from when you're talking about the Yankees.
Right. You know, I think they're probably right on that. I didn't play with all of them, of course, but I read about them, and with the small amount of media coverage the older guys got, you know, especially for young kids, I can't even imagine how great Babe Ruth was, and Garrett, and I knew Mantle was. And who was the other one they put it at?
Joe DiMaggio.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't fault that group. Joe wasn't the nicest guy in the world to people, but, you know, he was certainly one of the best ever. And it was, I was proud to be able to meet him, get a picture with him, and that was something else.
Now, one of the things that was particularly charming about when the Yankees were under Fritz is you mentioned practically every Yankee you played with. And it's going to bring back a lot of memories for especially the guys who are not frontline players, you know, who are bench players, who are utility or, you know, pitchers in the back of the rotation or in the back of the bullpen.
Sure.
And, well, why did you decide to do that?
You know, because those are the guys that I remembered more so than, like, the Tommy Kreshers, who everybody knew was good, and then he started failing a bit. But some of those guys made big impressions on me in one way or another, some funny, some sad, some happy, some. But I just wanted to, it came out. I just wanted to say something like that Luke Lamboli guy, you know, whoever heard of him. Mm-hmm. Well, he was my first friend in the minors, and he was the first time that I saw somebody get released, you know, or fired and just thrown away, and it hurt me. And I remember Luke, I wanted him to be my friend or my teammate as far as I went. But he went, and that was it. I thought, how can that happen to somebody? Just be standing there one day and get a pink slip in your hand, and you're out of business. So I mentioned him and then a few other minor leaguers that were really fun people and great experiences for me.
Now, this is your third book.
Right.
Does it get easier as you go along, or do you find you have trouble deciding what to write about? I mean, what's your process?
No, I don't have any trouble finding what to write about. I do find that I learn a lot each time, and I have a lot of learning to go. And I want to almost, in the Facebook, apologize to some of the people who bought my book that don't understand that I wrote that, and you know, you pointed it out to me, I really should have had an editor. And it would have helped out in a lot of places, but I just wanted to get it out there in case something happens to me, because I go every 6 months to my cancer doctor, and you know, one of these times he's going to say, well, we got a problem. But right now it's been taken care of by hormone therapy shots, so I never know. And I have a plan on doing like 4 or 5 more.
Really?
And and if I can afford it, I'll have an editor.
And now, this is an interesting point you bring up for writers who self-publish, the difficulty in bringing a quality product to market. What is it that prevents self-published authors from doing this? Is it the fact that they think they know better than other people, or is it a cost factor, or what is it?
I would think it's a cost factor, at least for me anyway. It has been. But now, I mean, I look at all three of the books, and I see lots of things I could have done differently, and I'm going to do the Mickey Mantle is Going to Heaven book differently because I want to take a lot of that religious stuff out of there that I put in. And I also want to redo the When the Yankees Are on the Fritz. There's some typos even on the back cover. But again, I was a PE major, not an English major, and I just want to share my experiences with people rather than worry about commas and semicolons and what gender, how to say different words.
Now, I'm curious, well, why do you want to take out the religious elements from your first book?
Because it was the second one. That was the first, yeah. I feel differently about some of the things now that I was in the process of learning at that time, when I really found out a lot of stuff that changed my thoughts on religion. Uh-huh. And since that time, when that book came out, I think in 2009, I've done a lot more studying, and I think I have many more answers than I had at the time. And I would be plainer and simpler and easier, instead of having to try to figure out, you know, who's on, who's going to go to the Lake of Fire for a visit or what. I think it's much better than that.
That's quite an interesting observation. All right, I'll get you out of here on this. You mentioned dozens and dozens of players who were your teammates. There is one who is conspicuously absent. Why you didn't write anything about Mike Kekich?
Well, I didn't, because on my first book, my wife told me that she didn't want to see his name in the book, and she didn't want her name in the book, because, and I did that only because I wanted to get the book out. I'll take care of that other stuff in the next book or two. You know, it's all coming out.
Well, what do you think about that movie? That proposed movie. What do you think about that?
I think it's coming, and I can't wait. My wife doesn't want it to come. Oh yeah, I'm a consultant on that. But they don't tell me what they're doing in the front office now. You know, with it. I know they hired a guy by the name of Jay Roach to be the director, and I think Ben Affleck and Matt Damon are going to be co-producers. So I think that changed, which I'm not unhappy about, because they're both really Red Sox fans, and I. But at least they're not Met fans. I'm sorry about that, Ron.
That's all right. It's part of the business. We've been talking about Vince Peterson, author of When the Yankees Are on the Fritz, Revisiting the Horace Clark Era. His other books include Mickey Mantle Is Going to Heaven and The Art of Deconditioning, Eating Your Way to Heaven. Fritz, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Hey, thanks, Ron. Always nice talking to you.
And that was Fritz Peterson, our guest on this week's Bookshelf Conversation. I hope to be getting back to these things on a regular schedule, so come back again next time, when our guest will be another fascinating figure in the world of baseball literature, music, art, who knows. It'll be a surprise to me as it will be to you. If you have any questions, please drop me a line at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com and visit ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf.com for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews in the world of baseball pop culture. So long, everybody. So grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a wonderful game."
We've been talking with Rob Fitz, author of Mashi, The Unfulfilled Baseball Dreams of Masanori Murakami, the first Japanese major leaguer. Rob, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.